Sheffield
run into?
She picked up a merchant ship that it actually the cargo was mainly rubber, and obviously very, very important to the German war effort. You know, so many uses for insulation and every kind of. It was the pure rubber from somewhere in the Far East.
But you,
anyway,
you came across nothing.
We were within. You know, we weren't within shooting distance of this, but we were knowing it was going on, and we couldn't wait to get there, but didn't. No, and we were, I think, deliberately kept in a quiet operational area while the ship pulled itself together. See, she'd just come out of a total rebuilding as a result of a mine or a bomb which had gone right through her. And she'd been out of action for a very long time. And she was a big ship to get worked up properly. We had, of course, 4 3-inch turrets and 2 batteries of 6 4-inch guns and Oerlikons coming out of their ears. And by this time, you know, everything was stacked up. You couldn't move without tripping over a upper deck magazine full of 20 millimeter or 40 millimeter or 2-pounder or something. And and they were getting us ready to do that run to Kola Inlet with the Arctic convoy. And so I suppose, in a sense, while the Denmark Strait Patrol was important, it was less demanding than a number of the other jobs that cruisers did, and we used the time very sensibly and got ourselves as worked up as we could. And then we did trips with the Arctic convoys. And but I didn't last very long. What happened? First thing that happened was that the 25th Destroyer Flotilla, which was building at that time Grenville, Ulster, Urchin, Undania, this gang of U's, it was the U class, they didn't have a gunnery officer for them. And I think they decided that they really needed somebody to go and work up this flotilla. Anyway, I wasn't in anybody's bad books, so I didn't get fired, but I had left the Belfast and went to the 25th Flotilla, and then I went almost directly from there. I was only there for a short time, and the dockyards, the building yards, went on strike. And so the ships didn't come off in time. I only got 3 of them. And I was at Scapel as gunnery officer of the 25th Flotilla. And I worked up Grenville, Ulster, and Urchin. And then we ran out of ships. But the Haida and the Huron came up. Mm. And I asked if I could do them. And I was given the job of working those two up. Mm. And had a very good go with Herbert Rayner and
Huron.
Yeah, and Haida, which was Harry DeWolf.
Harry DeWolf.
And no sooner got them worked up than down they went and got into action and started shooting people up.
This is in the Channel.
In the Channel.
Captain then, Hopman was there, Captain D, and Biscovica.
I put this thing the wrong way around. I was in the flotilla first.
Yeah.
And when I didn't get anything more to do, I did the Canadian ships, and I worked up 2 Indian ships, a couple of RN tribals, and 1 Greek, and then the work sort of became reduced, and that's when I was sent to Belfast.
Oh, I see.
Now, so I got those mixed up.
That's okay.
Because, there wasn't too much to be done in the flotilla work, and Canada just bought six-inch cruiser. They, again, I hadn't bought it, but they were taking it over. She was in Charleston. And I think that the whole purpose in sending me to Belfast was to get me groomed up so I could run a six-inch cruiser. And I got word of this, and by George, I got knuckled down to make certain that there wasn't anything that was going to happen in Uganda that I didn't know anything about. And, of course, they were identical. Everything was, well, there was more of it, that's all, in the Belfast. Mm-hmm. So by the time they wanted me back in Canada, I already had a very, very good basic education in six-inch cruisers. I still just a young lieutenant, of course, a couple of years.
Well, I know.
Things speed up in wartime.
Not a hell of a lot as far as the regular force is concerned, as you well remember. Anyway.
Well, you're an experienced gunnery officer.
I'll tell you this, that I was the only lieutenant who was gunnery officer of any ship anywhere.
Yeah.
Any six-inch cruiser, anyway. Oh, I just loved that. I had a wonderful time.
So you joined Uganda, and who was captain then?
Rollo Mingi. Hugh Pullen was number one.
Hugh Pullen was XO.
And all the rest of the executive officers were reserves. Maybe Chadwick. I don't know whether he was reserve and joining the RCN or whether he was RCN at that time. But I don't want to go into his career anyway.
Okay.
He can give you his own version of how he did things. Anyway, we joined up in Charleston, South Carolina. The ship was completely refitted by that yard, except that the electronic part of its refit had to be done in England.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had everything for an ops room, but no equipment. All the stuff, all the wires were on the bulkheads, mm-hmm. and so on. And did you ever meet Dick White?
Dickie White from Ottawa?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Well, Dickie was the torpedo officer.
Yeah.
And John Robarts, who later became Premier of Ontario, he was the direction officer, mm-hmm. and I was gunnery. Mm-hmm. Well, we knew what equipments we were going to get, but we had nothing about them except one or two very sketchy handbooks. So Dick and I took these handbooks of showing pictures of a TIU. We identified, using my magnifying glasses, what kind of cathode ray arrangements they had, and we found a cathode ray arrangement, measured it, and we converted all these things into sizes and then put them on the bulkheads. We laid out the whole ops room with nothing to do except to just, all we knew was the correct dimensions of one of the idiot boxes. And it worked out very well. Everything got in the right place. When we went to England, they slipped them all in, and that was that. But and Dick and I were very fast friends. The traditional difficulties between gunnery and torpedo were pretty fictitious. We really got on well. But it was certainly enacted while we were there, because when the RN still had the ship, the gunnery officer ran the torpedo officer in and put him under arrest.
What on earth for?
They didn't bring us into the seamy side of their problems. Put him under close arrest.
Who did?
Gunnery officer put the torpedo officer under close arrest.
You're the gunnery officer.
No, I had just joined. The RN still had the ship when we all went down.
We put Dickie White under arrest?
No.
Their own.
They had a gunnery officer and a torpedo officer who belonged to Uganda. And we went down to be present to take over. And we had to, before we had taken over, what there was to take over, that happened. But Dick and I got on well. We didn't have any trouble. And then we went over to the Pacific. We went first to Newcastle on Tyne and got, electronic refit. But that all that
we can
done.
Just, we can just finish this. Yeah, keep going.
We went to through the Mediterranean. We finished our work up on the Mediterranean, went through the Suez Canal down to...
Wasn't Mook on board?
Mook who?
Madrick?
No.
That was the other cruiser, the later cruiser. Yeah.
Later,
yeah.
Ontario.
Yeah, you were out there first, that's right.
Wag Richardson.
Yeah.
Was the other gunnery type.
So what did you do in the Pacific?
Then we joined up with the Pacific Fleet.
Now, Bruce Fraser was out there running it by then, because I was under him in the home fleet. And he left us, and Sir Henry Moore took over, and he came out to the Pacific.
Right.
So,
and he was in Australia.
Yeah.
Well, we got into the Pacific via Sydney, Australia.
Yeah.
And then worked up through Manus and Leyte, and joined the British Pacific Fleet, the task group that was their fleet. And we stayed there until the Canadian government insisted that everybody volunteer, and everybody didn't volunteer, so we came back to Canada, and just back 2 weeks and the war was over.
Now, what action did you see out there?
Well, the only defensive action was kamikaze. The fleet was attacked. My ship, Uganda, was never attacked. Mm. But I guess the greatest danger we suffered was falling shrapnel.
Yeah.
We did one bombardment of truck and one bombardment in the Sakishima Gundo, the islands down the south of Japan. And we're operating mainly for the benefit of our carriers off the coast of Japan, and the attacks were on the mainland.
Who were your bombardments for? Were there troops going ashore there?
No, airfield.
Just knock off the airfields.
Yeah.
Now, it's a sad little bit of our history, this Uganda bit. The signal that was sent, of course, was outrageous. Everybody said, I joined for the duration of the war, I volunteered once, I'm not going to volunteer again. There must have been a lot of bad feeling in the ship for those that wanted to stay and those that wanted to go home. Would you talk about that? I don't know. I just presume that must have happened. I know Rollo Mingi always felt very badly about it.
Well, I think that at some levels there was bad feeling. I never occurred to me not to volunteer. As a regular force officer, there was no difficulty in the decision. As far as I was concerned, it was a very simple decision to take. I didn't even get mad because they asked me. Instead of they're going to ask me, there's no question about what I do. I have no right to do anything else anyway. And as far as my own activity is concerned, I called together all my chief and POs, gunnery chiefs and POs, and I said, it may occur to you that some of you who aren't regular force people, or permanent force, we call them that, may feel it's better to go home and get the leave that's been promised and the big money and all that sort of stuff. But I'm sure that if you do, if you vote to, or don't volunteer for service in the Pacific, and a sufficient number do that, the ship has to go home, that no matter what you think about it now, you're going to regret it all your life. You're going to be sorry you made that decision, because there's something that is, doesn't matter how you rationalize, there's just something that in the face of the enemy, you're turning your back. And I'm sure that if you reflect on this long enough, you'll decide that this isn't the way to do it. And I to that extent, I said, I hope you'll all try to bring yourself to say you'll volunteer and do what has to be done. And if enough chief and petty officers do that, then I'm quite sure the rest of the ship's company will easily fall in line. And I think that's the only argument that makes any sense. I don't think we should try to determine whether the government is making a good or a bad decision, whether it's mean to think that they're asking everybody at home to volunteer, and here we're already on station. And I don't think the considerations of where you said you'd sign up for hostilities only and then turn around and get asked a question like this should be brought into it at all. Well, all the officers didn't feel the way I did. And I don't want to go into any names about this because I don't think that would be fair. I think the history, they've got to tell their own history. But there were some of the officers who had a very influential way with the ship's company. One or two were greatly admired by the ship's company. I think if there was a popularity contest, not because they did things that, to make themselves popular, but they were respected more than some of the others. I think some of them had more respect, had earned more respect than I had. And I felt that if they had made the decision on the basis that I made mine, or what the way I asked people, that the ship would have stayed there. And what a pity we didn't. But these people, whether they were incensed or not because they'd said they'd be fight for hostilities, anyway, they said there was a principal involved and they didn't like being asked, and so they weren't going to volunteer, and that's all there was to it. And they took with them a very large portion of the ship's company. The officers do it, we do it. We'll do what he said. Mr. So-and-so says we do this, that's what we're going to do. And he did. And that did it. So we had to go back. And the only other thing that was obvious to me anyway, I said, look, you see every day 1,000 aircraft, roughly, from our one group, 1,000 sorties a day, going and banging away at targets in Japan. And they now come back and drop their jettison their bombs. They can't find any targets. There isn't anything moving in Japan. They've cleared the railways. They're all set up. There are no vehicles moving. They've hit all the small targets. And now they're having great trouble finding anything to hit. How long can a country stay in a war that's put in this horrible situation? So it's only a matter of a very short time, and we're not taking great risks. I think that I told them that, as far as I was concerned, we were bound to have more kamikaze attacks, but they weren't the kind of attacks that were going to kill very many people, and they weren't the kind of attacks that were going to sink very many ships. And anyway, they weren't trying to sink cruisers. They're trying to sink aircraft carriers. But anyway, it didn't do any good. We turned turtle and turned tail and came back home. I was no sooner back in Esquimalt than sent on leave. And I picked up my wife in Ottawa, and we went down to the Scenery Club, and we no sooner got there than the bombs had dropped, and that was it. Now, if for the sake of that, what, 6 weeks?
About that.
We had been just enough guts to stay there. Then Rollo Mingy would have been at the table when the surrender was received. What a thing for Canada.
Marvelous.
And after, now if you take into consideration Hong Kong, when you remember when the war was first declared, we sent Canadian troops to Hong Kong. But after they were overrun, and after Pearl Harbor, there was no organized Canadian unit fought in the Pacific except Uganda in any service. There were no Air Force, there were no Army units, no naval units but Uganda. That was our entire contribution. What a pity that we didn't capitalize on that. So, the end of the war, nothing. And yet, our CNS-to-be would be at the table. So that's the end of the story, as far as I'm concerned, except for Korea, of course.
Well, on behalf of Dr. Douglas, thank you. As for me, I've had one more wonderful session with you, Bill.
Well, we'll not much more of a session.
Well.
There were a few things I probably might have amused you, but I don't. I really should have used this book. I've got to be back in the house of Dr. Vesta, who's a German, and his wife is German. They're both doctors, and for about 2 months they've been at us to come and visit them at tea time. And my wife, finally, she doesn't like this because she can't sit very long. Finally she said, look, I'm up to it, I'm going to have a go today.
Oh,
so, but this was before I said I would come here, and so I have to go.